This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Early in the 20th century, a blight swept through the forests of the eastern United States. Within 4 decades, some 4 billion American chestnut trees were dead. 4 billion trees. That is enough to fill 9 million acres. The species was threatened with extinction. This was a tree that had dominated forests from Maine to Alabama. In this portion of the program, we'll hear about the quest to save the American chestnut, then and now. Our guest is science writer Susan Frankel. She is the author of American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree. Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Susan Frankel is a freelance science journalist. Her work has appeared in many magazines, including Discover Health and Smithsonian, American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the phone numbers if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon. Susan Frankel, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
4 billion trees, enough to fill 9 million acres. What did the landscape look like before the blight and by the end of the 1940s? Can you give us some sense of how this changed the landscape?
Well, it changed. The heart of chestnut country was in the southern Appalachians, in North Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, southwest Virginia, and then sort of up along the Appalachians into the Adirondacks. And, you know, if you were living in a city, you might have noticed the effects of the blight because there were some cities, notably like Philadelphia or New York, where chestnut trees were pretty common, and they were sort of a common park tree, and they disappeared. But the place that you would really have noticed it would have been in rural areas, along ridgelines in the mountains. The trees really liked elevation and liked slopes. And, you know, and I've seen pictures of forests where the chestnuts began dying out, and you'll just see, in some cases, this big swath of a ridgeline with, you know, trees missing, or I quote in the book, there was one guy who went through a patch in central Virginia. He described going through what he called a 2-mile graveyard of big trees. At the same time, I think, you know, these things happen, and it's kind of amazing how much we can lose without noticing. I think for the people who lived side by side with the tree, or people who had trees in their backyards, or went to Prospect Park in New York where there were a lot of chestnuts, they might have noticed it. And then I think there were probably a lot of places where this catastrophe went by completely unremarked.
Yeah. And you note in the book that we're more likely to be familiar with the story of Dutch elm disease than the chestnut blight.
Mm-hmm. Because Dutch elm, the elm trees really were the quintessential town tree, and the chestnut was a rural tree. And I think that the people to whom it was most important were the rural poor, the ones who had sort of the most intimate relationship with the tree, and they weren't the ones, sort of writing poetry in verse about the chestnut in the way that people did about the elm.
How did the death of all these trees change the quality of life for people who were living in the eastern U.S., the rural poor?
Well, again, in the southern Appalachians, the tree was this very kind of valuable ally. in an effort to make a living off of what was very difficult land. So settlers in the Appalachians came, and they found these great big wonderful trees that were a terrific source of timber and of a kind of lumber that was very rot resistant. So it was good for building their houses. It was good for making fencing. It was good for, you know, making shingles. People used every part of the tree. They brewed the leaves into home remedies for coughs, and then they also were a fabulous source of food because the nuts that the trees bore were very nutritious, and unlike a lot of other nut-producing trees, chestnuts produced nuts reliably every single fall. And what happened in the late 19th century, early 20th century, once you started to get railroad lines and roads into that part of the country, was that people used the tree. The tree became a valuable cash crop, essentially. And people in the southern Appalachians would harvest the nuts and use the money from that to buy the sorts of things they couldn't make on their own. I talked to a guy in southwest Virginia who remembered vividly his family going out in the fall collecting nuts and then going to the nearby country store in order to buy shoes or just buy school books. It was kind of that bit of income that could often make the difference in families getting through the winter okay and kind of being hungry all winter long. And when the trees began to disappear, that spelled the end to this very important cash crop. And I say in the book, I think for a lot of people in that part of the country, it kind of became, the death of the trees kind of became conflated with the loss of a whole way of life that probably would have disappeared anyway, because you had, this is, you know, mm-hmm. around the time of World War I, that between the two wars, you had the Great Depression. You had, you know, massive changes going on that were making it more difficult for people to have a subsistence farm in the mountains. But for a lot of people, the chestnut and then the loss of the chestnut became a symbol for that change.
Yeah. How did the death of these trees affect wildlife in the region?
It's not entirely clear. The trees were a great boon for wildlife. You know, everything that lived in the forest ate them. And anecdotally, a lot of people talked about seeing less wildlife, fewer squirrels, fewer black bear, fewer deer. The only even partially documented impact is it may have had an effect on a few species of moth that fed exclusively on chestnut. But I think the disappearance of the trees along with other changes in the forest, you know, created more impoverished environments for wildlife. And so, you know, in general, you don't see the kind of rich array of animals and birds that you might have in the early 20th century. And the loss of the chestnut was one big piece of that.
Yeah. That person that you mentioned a little bit ago, from who remembers going with his family to harvest to pick up the chestnuts. I believe you're talking about
Early McAlexander.
Yeah. And he's someone who talked with you about the trees. Another fellow who talked with you about the trees, Barry Price, a retired trucker. How do folks who remember the chestnut or who just have an appreciation for the chestnut, how do they talk about the tree?
With great love. There is this huge nostalgia for the tree. In particularly, although not exclusively, in the southern Appalachians. And you just come across people who have these very dear memories. Barry Price actually is a little bit younger. Early McAlexander, the gentleman I mentioned, he's in his 90s and still going strong. Barry Price is, I think, in his 50s, but he used to go out with his grandfather into the woods to try to find chestnuts that were still around and to help his grandfather try to, he called it doctoring the trees. You know, so from childhood, I spoke with a retired school teacher who had had a tree on her farm and actually had a photo, this little black and white photo of the tree, the sort of thing, the kind of photo you would have of a relative or a friend from childhood. And in a way, I think that's how people thought of it. It was a friend of theirs.
Yeah. Before we go much further, maybe you'd describe the American chestnut for us, because I've never seen one.
It was a great timber tree. It was tended to grow. It's a very fast-growing tree. It grows straight up, and in the old-growth forest, it was a tree that could become very large, up to 100 feet or more, and 14, 15, 16 feet around. When it's growing out in the open and doesn't have to compete for sunlight, it kind of bushes out, and you can have these kind of massive trees that sort of look like giant heads of broccoli. But the timber tree, which is the tree that people have the most affection for, is the forest tree. Just a big, massive tree. When people, the guy who started one of the main groups trying to bring it back, the American Chestnut Foundation, when he started to try to drum up support for that, he used to compare it to the sequoias and tell people he was trying to bring back the sequoias or redwoods of the East Coast. And they're a little bit, they're not quite as big as sequoias, but they're a little like that.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Susan Frankel. We're talking with her about the American chestnut. She's written a book on the subject, American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Join the conversation with a question, a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. We've got a listener waiting for us now in Vermilion County in Belgium on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, ma'am. Good afternoon to the guest, too.
Hi.
I would like to point out that up until, I haven't recently seen them, but up until fairly recently, 20 years ago, you could still find large logs of chestnut lying in the woods in different places, because the wood is very, very hard to rot. It doesn't rot very, very fast at all. And they truly are huge trees. They would be 10, 15, 20 feet in diameter. They were very, very large trees in the forest. But what I wanted to point out to you is that there are other trees that are rapidly disappearing from our forest that are they're brought on by blights from different countries. The chestnut blight was brought in, or the Dutch elm disease, which was brought in. There's also one for the butternut tree, which is a type of walnut that is very scarce, and it's disappearing rapidly.
That's absolutely true, and one of the things that one of the things that sort of astonishes to me and is both sort of depressing and hopeful about the chestnut story is you're right. There are a good half a dozen to ten forest trees out there whose existence is once again threatened by pathogens or pests that have been brought in from overseas. It's as if we just never quite learn the lessons that were the chestnut blight had to offer. People are actually using some of the restoration techniques that have been used in the effort to bring back the American chestnut and hoping to apply those to other trees. The butternut is actually one of them that it would work with. But you're absolutely right. It's astonishing. And, the hemlock is in danger, the butternut, dogwood, Fraser fir, I could go on.
Yes, ma'am. There are several of them. The thing I wanted to point out, though, is that we destroy forests at a huge rate without ever really thinking about it. We clear cut it, and we don't really think about all the ramifications for that. And just wanted to point that out. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thanks for the call. Has this project, doing this book, has it given you a new appreciation of the landscape and of our natural resources?
Yeah, it has. I mean, it was a funny project for me because I'm not really a nature writer. I came to this from more of a health science background, but I got really interested in this story after writing a story about another tree disease that's been happening out in California, sudden oak death. And so inevitably, I mean, I've become more aware of what's around me, sort of slowly, painfully trying to learn the names of trees. I'm not great at it, but and more aware of sort of the health of what I'm seeing, or not, you know, lack of health of what I'm seeing, and more tuned in to the kinds of problems that are around us.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in St. Charles, line one. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. You know, this is right up my alley. I want to say forester, sort of. I worked for the Forest Service for a number of years out west. I was a forester slash firefighter and kind of like a jack of all trades. But I've seen how the forest has been decimated. This gentleman who called up earlier or before me and said, you know, clear-cutting. It isn't so much clear-cutting anymore. It's diseases. There's a pine blight out west. It's just decimating the forest. It's basically killing off all the pines that are left. And the reason I called in is you're talking about the chestnut, but the ecosystems of 150 years ago, it used to be we're not letting, man is controlling way too much of the ecosystem and not letting the natural process happen. And when I say this, as I'm saying strictly control burning-wise, I've seen what it does. People in Yellowstone can attest to this. We used to have fires that go through and decimate forest, and it would rejuvenate it, actually, the reverse ecosystem, so to speak. It isn't just cutting down trees. I mean, I think the environmentalists have gone a little bit overboard. And I know this because I'm into building trades right now, that we're buying more of our logs, our timber, from out of the country than any other place in the world. We're not buying our own lumber anymore because it's been said that we can't cut our trees down. Now, I've seen in the Northwest what logging in the past has done, and it's clear cutting is not right. But there are forests, and there's you know, not just, you know, I want to say pines, but all trees of all species are, when they're properly done, when the managed forest is properly done, it's great. And it just seems like we're losing that aspect of it, and we're all going to pay the price because of a few bad apples. I don't think that's right. How do you feel about this?
Well, I'm not a forestry expert, but I know you're right. I know that there is this sort of change of policy in the Forest Service now to do more controlled burns because people have begun to recognize how vital a role fire played in shaping forests and keeping forests healthy. Doing this book gave me an appreciation for just what a complex ecosystem the forests are. And, you know, one of the big concerns for folks out east now is actually in the wake of the chestnut blight, the major tree that came and filled in were oak trees. And what you have now are these forests filled with oak trees, all that are about somewhere between, you know, 70 and 90 years old. And they're all in the midst of this gigantic decline that's a combination of stress and drought and age and diseases. And it's a tremendously complex problem to deal with that, you know, goes beyond the issue of controlled burns or not. So I can't speak a whole lot more to what you're saying, but I think that it's become clear that forest management is a more complicated matter than just, you know, putting out fires and cutting down where we want. Forests are a pretty complicated system.
Yeah, and it's I'm sorry. Go ahead, caller.
No, you're right. I'm glad. This is something that's dear to my heart. I grew up, all my education's behind it. And I didn't get into the forestry aspect. My whole goal was to be a forester. Mm-hmm. But because the environmentalists put that to bed, basically I was out of job. So I got out of college education. I'm basically doing something else. But here's the point I'm trying to get. Just the small amount of schooling and the things that I've done and I've seen and the people I work with is that this. Mankind, everybody's focusing on don't cut the trees down. But the problem is the builders. The problem is the encroachment of mankind into the woods. And a good example of what I'm talking about is what happened in Southern California this year. If it were allowed, like it used to be now in the 80s, I'm talking about maybe, you know, 20 some odd years ago, you used to be able to allow to control burn and use it as a buffer zone at the same time as an ecosystem thing, you wouldn't have the loss of property that you have every year in spots. Man wants to build in the woods, even out here. I see this all the time. And then they don't manage what they have. It ends up going to pot. And it's because man doesn't understand nature. And until we enforce that, that fire is good in some aspects, and that clearing out certain species of trees is good aspects, people are going to get this idea that the environmentalists say, don't touch it, leave it alone, and that's wrong also. And I'll get off now. I want to thank you very much for having this lady on. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
He's very impassioned. One of the things, though, that his call and your comment rang a bell in my mind is that in the American Chestnut, one of the stories that is part of this is the story of forestry. And forest pathology is a relatively new discipline.
Yeah.
It only goes back 100 years.
Yes, and you know, forest pathology was just kind of getting underway on the heels of plant pathology when the chestnut blight hit. And, you know, it was hard sort of looking back and realizing that they just really, it was hard for people to know exactly what to do because this was such a young discipline. And I think the blight has sort of stood as for 100 years as the science's biggest failure because they never did quite figure it out. Mm-hmm. All of this, likewise the Forest Service was only, 2 or 3 years old when the blight hit
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener in Effingham, line 2, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I have an American chestnut. I grew it from seed. The mature tree itself was planted in the early 50s. The ground was so poor, it took it over 30 years before it got big enough to bloom. By that time, the blight was over. And since that time, that property's been sold, and the people didn't know what they had, so they cut them down. But I germinated some from seed and am growing them. And I wondered if there was a program to reestablish the American chestnut, or are they staying with the cross with the Chinese chestnut? And I'll get off to listen to your answer.
Okay.
A couple of things. One is I just want to comment. The blight isn't over. The blight fungus still persists in the woods, and it is as virulent as ever. You don't see the impact that it has because there just aren't as many trees out there. There is a program. There are a couple of programs, but probably the most prominent of those is the American Chestnut Foundation, which started in 1989. And takes as its starting point that it's going to cross American chestnuts with Asian trees, which are resistant to blight, but then proceeds through a breeding program that allows them to gradually dilute out the Chinese characteristics all but for the blight resistance and kind of build up the American characteristics. So the goal of the program has been eventually to have a tree that's about 15/16 on average, American. And that program is going strong. They in 2005, I believe, harvested what they hope is the first crop of nuts that will be grow into blight-resistant trees. They don't know yet whether that's actually true or not. It's got several thousand members in 13 states, and they are going great guns with big plans for bringing back the tree.
Mm. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line 3, hi.
Hello. When I was growing up in Connecticut, there was a tree by a neighbor's house that we called a horse chestnut, and I was told that the nut was poisonous. Can you tell me the difference between a chestnut, a horse chestnut, and perhaps a buckeye? Isn't a buckeye a kind of chestnut?
Well, they're completely different species. I don't know. You know, maybe it's just because the seeds look a little similar. They both get called chestnut, but the horse chestnut and the buckeye are. I'm going to mangle the name. Aeschylus is the genus of the trees, and chestnuts are castaña. They belong to the beech family. They are completely unrelated with one another.
So the beech tree then is related to the chestnut.
It is, very broadly speaking. The oaks are also a member of that family. It's a big family.
Yeah. I recently had dinner at a friend's house where we ate chestnuts. Where do we get the chestnuts from if they're all gone?
chestnuts there's
seven different species of chestnut, and the ones that, most of the ones that we get today, if you're sort of east of the Mississippi, a lot of them come from Europe, from Italy and Switzerland. Those are European chestnuts. They are also vulnerable to the blight fungus, but they didn't, for a variety of reasons, they didn't have the kind of widespread deaths that the American chestnut suffered. And then if you're west of the Mississippi, I don't know if that's literally the dividing line, but it seems to me like where I am in San Francisco, the nuts that we buy are from Asia. They're either Japanese or Chinese chestnuts, and they usually come either from Japan, China, or Korea. They're much bigger. In both cases, those nuts are much bigger than the classic American chestnut, which was about the size of an acorn. They tend not to be as sweet. I was really surprised when I tasted American chestnut at how sweet and crunchy it was, because I didn't love chestnut otherwise. So you're either getting from Asia or you're getting from Europe.
Well, thanks for the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Did people eat them raw, or did they roast them like we do?
You know, they would roast them pretty much. But I have to tell you, I had some this year. There's a guy in Minnesota, Phil Rutter, who founded the Chestnut Foundation, and he raises sort of Americanoid chestnuts. They have some hybrid qualities, but they're really little, and shelling them to put in the Thanksgiving dressing was such a pain. I'd been told that. People had said, oh, you know, that's why they never really were widely cultivated, because they're so little, they're really not very much fun to shell and use.
How do you get the meat out of the shell?
Well, I've tried, in this case, I think what I did was I scored the shell and put it in the oven, and then they kind of popped out of the oven. I don't have a microwave, but that's actually very effective.
Yeah.
You just got to make sure to cut a line in the shell so they don't explode.
So it's the same way we roast the chestnuts.
Exactly.
That we get in the grocery store today.
Exactly.
That are imports. Exactly. Yeah. Very interesting. You were taken to see some surviving American chestnuts in Virginia, and no doubt you saw chestnuts elsewhere. Tell us about the trees you saw, and why have some survived?
That's the big mystery. The tree I describe in the book it's the biggest surviving tree in Virginia, and it's a grand, beautiful, big tree. There's a couple of theories about why some trees survived, and I guess I should clarify two things. One is there are these mature chestnuts that appear to have been able to endure being exposed to the blight and still survive it. There's also still millions and millions of small chestnut sprouts in the forest, because the trees have these root systems that are very resilient, and the blight doesn't kill the root, it just kills the trunk of the tree. And so what you have happening in forests all over is these trunks that are roots that are surviving, sprouts come up, and then as soon as they get, you know, to a certain size, not very big, the blight comes back and kills them off. And, you know, the thought is perhaps eventually, hundreds of years from now, the tree would figure out a way around this disease and those sprouts would survive. More likely, they would just eventually all die out. And so it's sort of functionally extinct, because most of the sprouts aren't capable of blooming. As for the ones, the few hundred that have survived and endured the blight, it's probably a combination of factors. It may be that they have some innate resistance, as happens in any population. There are often individuals that just have a genetic extra edge that allows them to survive epidemics. There's also they also may be carrying a virus that afflicts the blight fungus and slows its growth. And that's what saved the trees in Europe, was the presence of this virus. And it may be present on some of those surviving trees and allowing them to survive. In Europe, that virus worked really well to save the chestnuts in the forests and in orchards. In this country, for complicated reasons, it hasn't worked as well, and it hasn't really been a great strategy for saving whole forests, although it is can and has probably helped individual trees to survive the blight.
Science writer Susan Frankel is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about the American chestnut. She's written a book on the topic, American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us a little bit about this blight. Where did it come from? How did it get here? That kind of thing.
The blight is native to Japan and China, lived on chestnut trees there, co-evolved with those trees. Probably it was brought in on Japanese trees that began to be imported into this country in the late 19th century. Now, people always talk about the blight first showing up in New York. That was the first time that it was observed. A guy who worked at the what's now the Bronx Zoo noticed that the chestnuts there weren't doing very well and saw that they were sick, and he's the guy who first sort of, quote-unquote, discovered the blight. In fact, if you go back and look at the historical record, there are reports of sick chestnuts in scattered places on the East Coast. Pretty much any place that somebody planted a Chinese or Japanese tree in the late 19th century, there was a pretty good chance that tree was holding blight fungus on it and that it would become sort of the ground zero for its own little mini epidemic.
How does it infect a tree?
It sits in the bark, and different ways, actually. Basically, if there's any kind of wound in the bark of the tree, and that might be,
the scratch of a squirrel,
nibbling,
yeah.
It might be, a squirrel's claw or whatever. If a spore from the fungus finds its way to that little wound, then it gets in under the bark, and then it sort of sets up shop and gets going, and it'll develop sort of sprout a fungal mat that will start chewing up cells, the layer of cells that carry food and water from the roots to the rest of the tree. And eventually, when that layer of fungus sort of encircles the trunk or a branch or whatever and girdles it, everything above it dies.
How long does that take?
It depends on the size of the tree.
Oh, okay.
It can happen in a matter of months. It can happen over a couple of years. It sort of depends on how big the tree is and how virulent that strain of fungus is. But generally pretty quickly, a year or two.
Yeah. We've mentioned the fact that forest pathology and forestry is a young discipline, was brand new at the time when the blight struck. So how did folks begin to try to determine what the problem was?
Well, they were pretty stymied at first. In fact, the guy at the Bronx Zoo who first discovered it, he sent off samples to the USDA, and they kind of blew him off. They said, it's this other disease that's common. There were a couple of different sort of stages in that discovery. One was a pathologist at the New York Botanical Garden, which was right across the street from the Bronx Zoo, went over, took a look at it, and he soon recognized that he had never seen this kind of fungus before. He was an expert in funguses. And he just did a series of experiments where he would take samples of the fungus, infect a twig, look at how it killed the twig, and kind of laid out the life history of the fungus. And he did that very quickly. People still didn't know where it had come from, and it took several years before they figured out where it had come from. And they did that by sending this wonderful plant explorer named Frank Meyer, who's the guy who gave us Meyer lemons, and who worked in China for years. They sent a sample of fungus, of an infected bark to Frank Meyer, and sent him up into the mountains outside of Beijing and asked him to see whether he saw something like this on the trees there. And sure enough, eventually he found trees with that and was told by the local farmers that, you know, they had this problem every fall and the trees didn't die. They just kind of cut away the infected bark. And once that was in 1913, and once he identified that, and somebody later then identified them in China, in Japan rather, by that time then they had sort of the natural history and the kind of the story of the fungus figured out. You know, figuring out what it was and what caused it and how the organism worked was one thing. Nobody could figure out how to stop it, and that was pretty well apparent by, you know, the teens, that there was not going to be any stopping this thing.
Yeah. Were the Chinese farmers who cut away at the tree, were they successful in lengthening the life of the tree? Or?
Well, it doesn't kill Chinese trees.
Okay.
Because the Chinese trees had evolved with
yeah.
it. So they had sort of figured out, the trees in China and Japan had sort of acquired nice. The defenses that they needed to be able to have, to live with the fungus. So it's kind of a minor pest in those parts of the world and for those species. But, you know, for the American trees, it was like what happened to Native Americans when the Europeans arrived with all of their diseases that the Native Americans had never seen before.
Yeah. What was the thinking early in the 20th century about the importation of plants and animals, and did that change as a result of the blight?
Well, it was kind of a free-for-all in the early part of the century and in the 19th century. I mean, there were really very few controls. And it was partly because of the chestnut blight, partly because of potato famine, partly because of another disease called white pine blister rust that just decimated the pine trees in the west, in the western forest, also in the eastern forest, people in Washington began to realize they actually probably needed to do something to try to prevent dangerous bugs and diseases from getting into this country. And so one result of that was in 1912, Congress passed the first law, the Plant Quarantine Act, that was designed to try to staunch diseases and problems from getting into this country. And I guess basically, you know, plants might be imported, but then they had to be quarantined to show that they were safe. But again, you know, as I said earlier, one of the things that's surprising to me is that we keep having this problem. Invasive species is still an enormous problem, and we don't deal very well with it. The USDA inspects maybe 1% of all of the plants that are imported, and so we continue to get imported pathogens. You know, it's in California we're dealing with a disease, sudden oak death, that was caused by a water mold that was brought in from Asia. In the Midwest, you all are struggling with the emerald ash borer, which was something that was brought in unwittingly on wooden pallets from Asia.
Mm-hmm. So too the Asian longhorned beetle.
Asian longhorned beetle. You know, it's a very tough problem, and it's one that demands huge resources that we simply haven't devoted to it.
Yeah. You know, how concerned should we be? You know, you can make yourself word sick about some of these things, but, you know, is it possible, would it be possible to have a perfect storm of sorts where everything came together and you saw lots of trees, lots of different types of trees being sickened or wiped out?
Well, I think some would say we're in that perfect storm to some extent. You know, you know, as I said, I don't have an exhaustive list, but there's at least close to a dozen species of important timber trees that are endangered from different invasive species. Sudden oak death, which I keep coming back to, that was a disease that surfaced on the West Coast and began killing, as it turned out, just a limited number of species of oaks, and then skipped to the East Coast, basically through carelessness. And, you know, it's still not clear quite how virulent that is, but at one time people were really worried that that was a disease that could kill the major oak species on the East Coast. An oak is, probably a far more commercially valuable tree than chestnut ever was, and chestnut was a big deal. So, I don't want to sound alarmist because we have a lot of trees and a lot of forest, but I think that the problem of invasive species is one that we haven't really figured out adequate solutions to, and we haven't been willing to put adequate resources into A, better preventing the entry of things, and then B, doing better monitoring and tighter quarantining so that you don't have problems that surface in one part of the country moving to another.
Yeah, and we need to be, as citizens, we need to be a little bit more aware, and I know there's been quite an effort in the state of Illinois anyway to talk with people about firewood, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you use firewood that's right where you are, and you don't transport it.
Yeah, and, some people, because of sudden oak death here, people were calling for measures like, cleaning off your shoes and tires of your car when you go into the forest and you're leaving. I think trying to be more attuned to the possibility that we could be carrying unwanted things along with us.
Yeah.
The fact is we live in a global world. We live in a global economy. We all, hopscotch around the globe, and we're not going to stop that. And we're not going to stop importing things from other parts of the world, whether it's literally plants or whether it's things that come on wooden pallets that can carry things.
Well, we've lived in a global world for a long time now.
Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson, among others, were importing, interesting trees and, what they wanted in their orchard or what they wanted in their landscape.
Yeah.
So it's
been
global for a long time now.
Yeah, and that desire for something new and interesting is, pretty strong part of our impulses.
Makeup, yeah. You close the first part of the book with a short anecdote told to you by a storekeeper. He said, the old-timers used to say that after 100 years, the chestnuts will come back. The subtitle of your book is The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree. So where do we stand in terms of a comeback of the chestnut?
It's hopeful. It's no guarantee. As I mentioned, the American Chestnut Foundation is begun to breed some blight-resistant trees. There are also people working with genetic engineering in the hopes of being able to genetically engineer trees that can resist blight. As the chestnut scientists will tell you, getting a blight-resistant tree is one thing. Getting it back in the forest is a whole other story. And that's going to be the really big challenge coming ahead, is figuring out, even should they manage to develop a tree that is able to resist the blight, we're going to have to find places to put it, because it's not as if the forests have been sitting around and, with velvet ropes holding spots for the trees.
Yeah.
It's a question of a couple of different things, figuring out what kinds of trade-offs we're willing to make in order to make room for chestnut. Are people going to be willing to clear cut, because chestnuts need open light to grow? And it's also figuring out places to put them. One of the very hopeful programs that I talk about is an initiative it's an initiative to plant trees on abandoned surface mines. And it turns out, and I went to a place where actually the mountaintop had been blown off, and one of these awful mountaintop removal operations, and you just end up with this landscape that looks like the surface of the moon. But it turns out that some trees, including chestnut, grow really well in that kind of rubble. And so one possibility is seeding chestnuts in these abandoned surface mines, and there's tens of thousands of acres of abandoned surface mine all across what used to be the Chestnut Range. And,
the bottom line is it's a very long-term proposition. When I went to the American Chestnut Foundation meeting in October, they were talking about their 1,000-year plan. This is not something, we're not going to see chestnut forests in my lifetime, probably not in my children's lifetime. You know, I don't even know if in my grandchildren's lifetime. It's a very long-term proposition. These forests, you know, it took them millennia to get there, and it's going to take a long time to get them back.
It took millennia to get them there.
Yeah.
They were lost in a generation, and we're looking at 1,000 years.
Yeah. give or take a few centuries. What I liked about this story, and one of the things that made it not depressing to do, is I think it's a very inspirational story because people really hung with the chestnut, and people really took their love and nostalgia for that tree and said, we're going to bring it back. And they have worked really diligently at the science of trying to bring it back and have been really committed at figuring out ways to get it back into the forest. And I think you could come up with lots and lots of species of trees or flowers or animals, birds, fish, whatever, that are going to need that kind of help in the future. And so, I kind of like to focus on the glass half full part of it, that it may be very well be possible to do this.
We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Susan Frankel, author of American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree. The publisher, the University of North Carolina Press.